Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shemot. This week, Rabbi Howard Marcos discusses Shemot. Rabbi Howard Marcos is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Howard Marcos.
Thank you, Larry. When we look around at our world, we can certainly identify many, many elements that are breathtakingly magnificent. The sky at sundown, the vast oceans, a full moon on the 15th of a Hebrew month, childbirth. In all of these examples, I for one can't help but to think to myself, and at times even say out loud, this is how I know that there is a God out there. We human beings, we couldn't do any of those things with such resounding success. Not that we don't try, mind you. In every generation, there are those who do their best to attempt to replicate God's wonderful creativity. We send spaceships into orbit to try to conquer the galaxies. We experiment in cloning and other alternative methods of reproducing our species, and so on and so forth. And with all of the brain power at our disposal, while we may have come close to mirroring God's power, our attempts have been at best somewhat successful, and most often simply a feeble attempt. On a much less positive note, it seems that one of the most devastating prices of progress has been the rate in which people are contracting disease. It's not completely out of the question to link the Industrial Revolution to the rise of air and water pollution to the ills of cancer. In addition, the speed at which this world is going also at times creates an anxious world, one in which the pressures to succeed and to produce and to achieve and to get promoted and to excel weigh heavily on the shoulders of many of us. So what can we do? If one wishes to suggest that we slow down or stop progress, that's not likely to happen, mostly because unless everyone agrees to change the pace of the world's development, then the ones who do take their feet off the accelerator will be left behind. And who's willing to let that happen? Another approach to addressing this dilemma suggests that we can do nothing and that our commitment to endless achievement has the potential of being the cause of a great crash, such that we will need to almost start over again from the beginning in order to recreate a working world order. That, too, I believe, is a bit extreme in its analysis of the plight of our planet. In looking at this week's Torah portion, Parshat Shemot, I found hints to another approach that might be embraced in our striving to make our world a better place. It has to do with creating in our own social and psychological spheres a new beginning. I can't say starting over, because that would be way too difficult in this fast-paced world in which we live. Nevertheless, there are aspects of our lives that might just lend themselves to a renewal of a sort, or even a reinventing, inspired by some curious passages in our Torah found in Parshat Shemot. In the first chapter of the book of Exodus, we are informed that there was a new king who arose over Egypt, whom we are told, Asher lo yada et Yosef, who did not know Joseph. In this king's refusal to acknowledge Joseph's contribution to the welfare of the land of Egypt, we might feel that this new pharaoh is uncomfortable with the manner in which the foreigners, the Hebrews from the east, have made themselves at home in Egypt. His concern, as reported in our Torah, is that these Hebrews will continue to proliferate, and in doing so become a potential liability should Egypt choose to go to war against another nation, and the Israelites come to side with the Egyptian enemy. His plan is to kill the males born to the Israelite women, thereby creating a situation in which the next generation would be unable to recreate, and as a result, there would be no more major increases in the population, as were reported in our text. In 1979, the country of China passed legislation which prohibited families in the country to have more than one child. There were exceptions, of course, but in the majority of the provinces of China, a family which decided to defy the one-child law would be met with fines, forced abortions, and female infanticide. More on that phenomenon in a moment. In late October of this year, 2015, the law mandating that families only have one child was rescinded in China and replaced by one which now allows a family to have two children. While it may be an improvement to some extent, women's rights to control their own fertility are still dictated by the Chinese government. Some families have only known the social norm of one child, such that introducing a change in that norm is not so comfortable for many citizens. And in addition, the status quo that has been in force for more than a generation will most likely have a major effect on how the elderly will be treated for the next generation. Because instead of them being surrounded by loving family who would take turns tending to the needs of their grandparents or parents, they will have to hire outside caregivers. Because there's really only one of them in that generation who is around to look after the many family members. Governmental legislation to limit the number of children a family may have is nothing less than state-sponsored murder. The Chinese legal system and the edicts put forth by Pharaoh, king of Egypt, both led to the killing of innocent children, which naturally spilled over into resistance to have children altogether. While our podcast is not really the place to share anecdotes of Chinese citizens who responded one way or another to the decree in 1979, and again to the change of the law this past October, it is the time to share a perhaps familiar and relevant midrash with you about Parshat Shemot. When Pharaoh's proclamation to throw all male children born to Israelite mothers into the Nile River was issued, a man named Amram, who was one of the leaders of the Israelites, decided that in these circumstances, it was best for husbands to live separately from their wives. He set the example. He divorced his wife Yocheved and encouraged all of the men of Israel to do likewise. His daughter Miriam said to him, "Father, your decree is worse than Pharaoh's decree. The Egyptians aim to destroy only the male children, but you are including the girls as well who will not be born if the men separate from their wives. Pharaoh deprives his victims of life in this world, but you prevent children from being born at all, depriving them even of the world to come. You are a righteous man, Father, and it behooves you to change your decree." Amram acknowledged the just nature of Miriam's plea, and he took the matter to the Sanhedrin to be adjudicated. The members of the court responded to Amram's query by saying, "The mouth that forbade is the mouth that must permit. You are the one who said that husbands and wives must separate, and so it must be you who declares that the husbands must remarry their wives." Amram, fearing the wrath of Pharaoh and the Egyptians for defying the law of the land that all males are to be thrown into the Nile River, suggested that he and the members of the Sanhedrin remarry their wives clandestinely, to which came the reply, "And who will make this change in decree known to the whole congregation of Israel?" Accordingly, Amram stood publicly under the chuppah with his divorced wife Yocheved, while Aaron and Miriam danced around it, and the angels proclaimed, "Eim habanim smecha hallelujah, let the mother of children rejoice, hallelujah." And so it happened that the men of Israel followed Amram's example, and the community of Israel celebrated many, many remarriages. Amram was still frightened for the safety of his family, and as a result, God responded to his plea for mercy. God created a situation in which Yocheved would give birth 3 months prior to her projected date, a date which was known to the Egyptian authorities, who traveled from house to house to gather information on pregnancies, which were allowed, to determine when to return to check to see if a male was born, which resulted in the casting of those babies into the river. We read in the Torah, "Vatar ha'isha vateled bein, vatera oto kitovhu, vatitz penehu shlosha yirachim." Yocheved became pregnant and had a son. She saw how beautiful he was and succeeded in hiding him for 3 months. Realizing that she could no longer hide him, she reluctantly wrapped him up in a blanket, placed him in a basket, and floated him down the Nile River, hoping that he would be found and be taken care of. Let's look closely at the text that relates to its readers, the story of the birth of Moses. First of all, when he was born, the Torah text tells us, Vatera oto kitovhu. His mother saw that he was good, tov. What does this phrase, and she saw that he was good, remind you of? I can tell you that I hear an echo of the many statements found in our Torah during the creation story, in which we are told, Vayar Elohim ki tov, and God saw that it was good. Indeed, the Midrash suggests to us that the words Vatera ki tov, she, or Vayar ki tov, or he, saw that it was good, allows the reader to consider that the birth of Moses might be intended to be understood as the dawn of a new world, a better world. There's one more interesting aspect of the story of the birth of Moses that it's worth noting. When his mother reached a point where she realized that she could hide him no longer, she took him and placed him in a basket, which she then floated down the Nile. Our Torah tells us, Vatikach lo tevat gome, vatachmera vachemar uvazafet. She got a wicker basket for him and caulked it with bitumen and with pitch. The word for wicker basket is actually teva, which is the word that is used in only one other place in the entire Tanakh, and that is the story of Noah and the flood. The ark is called a teva and is used in that story no less than 25 times. Again, our story of the birth of Moses has within it a literary connection with a biblical story which signals a new era in history, the story of Noah and the flood. Thus, with the birth of Moses, in defiance of the edict of Pharaoh of Egypt, the Israelites could anticipate a rebirth. And with rebirth comes the opportunity to start things from the beginning, to try to fix that which is broken, to make the necessary adjustments in our behavior and in our environment so that the next generation can be born into a better world. Our story continues to hint to us the importance of being resolute in our stand on bettering the world. It's easy for us to be told that if we don't act now in ways that will improve our living conditions, then we are accelerating the destruction of our planet. It's much harder, I think, for an individual to take a position and act upon it. In fact, we are advised by the Mishnah, "B'makom she'ein anashim, hishtadel liyot ish." Where there are no people around, I would translate anashim as mention, who know how to do the right thing. When there is no mensch around, it is up to us, each of us, to try and be that ish, that mensch. Which brings us curiously to the next episode in the life of Moses. We learn that Moses grows up in Pharaoh's palace, having been drawn out of the water by Pharaoh's own daughter, and as a result spared the consequences of death by drowning. She raised Moses as her own son, even though he knew that he was an Israelite. One day he went out of the palace to check on what was the plight of his kinfolk. Moses sees an Egyptian man striking one of his own kind, a Hebrew man. His immediate and natural response is shared with us by the Torah. Vayifen ko vacho, vayar ki ein ish, vayach et hamitzri, vayitmenehu bachol. He turned this way and that, and when he saw that there was no man around, he struck the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. At first glance, this passage casts a questionable light on Moshe Rabbeinu. By stating he turned this way and that, and when he saw that there was no man around, are we being told that he was about to commit premeditated murder, having first checked to see if anyone was looking? I would suggest an alternative explanation to this verse, namely that Moses witnessed an injustice being committed and immediately sought help from others who were in the vicinity to address the violence that was taking place. His search for support was unsuccessful, however, not because there was no one around who would help him, but because there was no one around who would help him. Whether it was out of apathy or out of a fear of getting involved, Moses looked around and was not able to find a single mensch who would assist him. So he took matters into his own hands and struck the Egyptian in order to save his fellow Hebrew. It is not uncommon in life for us to be in an unpopular position with our peers. Every once in a while, we are called upon to be the mensch when no one else is able or willing to take that role upon herself or himself. Even more than that, taking an active role to protest, to offer constructive criticism, to take initiatives, to find ways to improve our world, all require us to be a mensch, especially when, after having looked around, we find that there are no mention, or shall I say, no honorable mention around. Are we similar to those who would just like to stay in the background, be on the sidelines, wishing to remain anonymous at a time when another is suffering injustice? Or are we able to speak up, share our discomfort out loud, and give of our time and energy to right the wrongs? Judaism is clear about this, that there is a time for each of us to step forward. Ubemakom she'en anashim hishtadel lihyot ish. When there are no mention around, for us, that time to be a mensch is now. Finally, this first parasha of the book of Shemot spends an inordinate amount of time on the first encounter between Moses and Aaron on the one hand, and Pharaoh on the other. It seems that as a result of the pair's insistence that Pharaoh let the Israelites go, not only did the king refuse, but he also decided to collectively punish the Israelites' slaves in a nasty way. Our text tells us that Pharaoh accuses Moses and Aaron of distracting the Israelites and keeping them from fulfilling their tasks, which mainly included making bricks out of straw. We read in Shemot chapter 5, verse 4, Vayomer alehem melech Mitzrayim, lama Moshe ve'aharon tafriu et ha'am mima'asav. Lechu lesivlotechem. But the king of Egypt, notice please that here he is not called Pharaoh, but more on that in a moment, the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you distract the people from their tasks? Get to your labors. Pharaoh is claiming that Moses and Aaron, by their insistence that the Israelites be freed from slavery, are keeping these slaves from doing their work as required by the taskmasters. Quite frankly, Pharaoh was absolutely correct in making this claim. The Israelites, who had already met with Aaron and Moses and had seen signs and wonders that these two men had prepared to show them, were convinced that their destiny, their immediate destiny, was shaping up to become freedom from Egyptian servitude. To dream of a new life such as that which was being promised to them by their God in a good and spacious land flowing with milk and honey would of course be distracting to the people. So on one hand, in response to this distraction, Pharaoh could have met the Lord halfway and acceded to the request that the Israelites be allowed to go into the wilderness for 3 days to worship their God. A shrewd leader, I think, would have been wise to say yes to that small demand, removing the distraction from the people, and then see to it that they return to the status quo. But Pharaoh was not so insightful. The text hints to this first by letting us know that he saw himself as the king of Egypt, a term found nowhere else in chapter 5 of Shemot, suggesting that instead of being a benevolent dictator who was looking out for the best interest of all the inhabitants of Egypt, he was just a mortal king whose authority was being challenged by an incorporeal force that was making him very uncomfortable. His first reaction was in fact to say, who is the Lord that I should heed him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go. A second hint by our text that Pharaoh was lacking in his ability to see the big picture is the wording of the king's response. Recall that he said to Moses and Aaron, why do you distract the people from their tasks? The word chosen to describe the act of distracting is tafriu, which you might recognize as a very common word in modern Hebrew, which means to bother. But in biblical Hebrew, this is one of only two places in the entire Tanakh in which the causative form of the root pei resh ayin is used. Why was this word the one placed in the mouth of Pharaoh to describe the belligerence of Moses and Aaron? I think that this word was the one chosen because it contains the same three letters found in the name of the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, or Paro. In other words, after the narrator calls Pharaoh the king of Egypt, stripping him of the title Pharaoh, when he speaks, he is unconsciously placing that regal authority that he wishes to possess over the people into the hands of Moses and Aaron. He is unwittingly saying to the pair, why are you being the pharaohs around here? Lama atem tafriu, which speaks directly to his loss of confidence as the one in power. Moreover, as a result of his feelings of inadequacy, he decides to punish the Israelites by limiting the amount of straw that the government will provide to them as they continue to make bricks. It's not that there was not straw that could be collected. It was just that the Israelites would now have to collect it themselves. I have to tell you that for a leader who would not to hesitate to throw baby boys to their premature deaths into the Nile, this punishment was quite lame, to say the least. Sure, it caused a stir within the camp, because the task became more difficult to fulfill. And we are told that as a result of the reduced productivity, the Israelite foremen were beaten. But it was not impossible to find straw throughout the land. And when these Israelite foremen, the liaisons between the Israelites and the Egyptian taskmasters, complained to Moses and Aaron that the Israelite slaves were the ones receiving worse treatment since they approached Pharaoh, Moses, who also was new at his job, brought the complaint to the Lord. I have a bigger plan for this people, responds the God of Israel. Vayomer Adonai el Moshe, ata tireh asher eseh lefaro, ki viyad chazaka yishalchem, uviyad chazaka yigarashem me'artzo. Then the Lord said to Moses, you shall soon see what I will do to Pharaoh. He shall let them go because of a greater might. Indeed, because of a greater might, he shall drive them from his land. This final verse in our parasha contains my final message of this podcast. God has plans for his people. We might not always know what they are, but we must always consider ourselves a partner with the divine in the fulfillment of our destiny. We must be initiators, active participants, and constructive in the manner in which we live our lives, hoping all the time that our path is the one that literally, with God's help, will lead to success and fulfillment. In the world around us, this might manifest itself in more activity that improves personal health, or the health of our environment, or the future of our planet. As the Israelites realized over and over again, their despair that they experienced as a result of the recurrence of challenging times brought upon them by a threatened ruler of Egypt was to be expected, but was also to be addressed and overcome in order to pave the way for their rebirth, their new beginning, starting from the exodus from Egypt, surviving the wandering in the wilderness next, then receiving God's law on Mount Sinai, and ultimately entering into the land of Canaan. It was true then that a rebirth was possible, and I believe that the challenge for conscious renewal continues to be there for us to take on today.
Thank you, Rabbi Marcos. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.